resuming as if I hadn't interrupted. He picked up one of the spring-forced clamps and squeezed it open, raising his eyebrows again.
Often placed on the nipples or nether lips. Do they use these in Sirius House?
No. I tugged at another drawer, but it was locked. Didier took a key from a chain about his waist and opened it. A row of slim-hafted, razor-edged steel blades gleamed against a red velvet lining, like a chirurgeon's tools, only beautiful.
"Flechettes," he said. "We require a reference and a guarantee for their usage."
He gave an involuntary tremor beside me, and his voice changed.
"I hate them."
I imagined an anonymous hand pressing the sharp point of one into my skin, tracing it slowly, a trickle of red following the bright blade. It would be very vivid against my skin. I came out of the reverie to find Didier watching me again.
"You are what the stories say, aren't you?"
The envy was mingled with an obscure pity.
"I hope Delaunay screens his clients well. Come on, I'll show you the upper levels."
My tour of Valyrian House continued for some time through a myriad of rooms. Seraglio boudoirs, baths, a folly garden, royal chambers, a harem, a throne room, a room of swings and harnesses, even a child's nursery, although Didier hastened to add that they abided by guild laws regarding the minimum age for adepts. In the flagellary, he lectured at length on the different types of whips and rods, crops, quirts, scourges, floggers, and torses, the cat-o'-nine-tails and the bullwhip, birches, canes, straps, and paddles. Of course, many patrons, he told me in his dry voice, preferred to bring their own implements. I never saw a single patron throughout the tour. It is the policy of the Night Court to provide privacy, but there were always patrons at Sirius House who treated it as a salon, meeting with friends and acquaintances to enjoy each other's company, as well as the services of Narmar. By contrast, Valyrian House was marked by an air of hushed secrecy. Fetes and galas were arranged with great care, Didier said, for very select guest lists. When all was said and seen, I was glad that I had gone to Delaunay and not to Valyrian House. Although there was nothing I saw that did not in some way intrigue me, it seemed a dull life without the spice of mystery and danger, and indeed even the cursed intellectual rigour that life as a servant of Narmar in the household of Anarfiel Delaunay promised. Any spark of disobedience or rebellion had been long conditioned from the adepts of Valyrian House, and how not when their motto was, "I yield"? Mighty Kushiel did not minister to the yielding, but to those who disobeyed and dared suffer the agonies of defeat. This I believed then, and I believe it still, though I dare say I might not have then, had I any inkling how long and difficult the path would be. At any rate, you may be sure that if I left Valyrian House without the wisdom of experience to support my beliefs, I left it considerably wiser in the ways of my art. I returned to Delaunay's house full of newfound knowledge, finding to my dismay that he had invited friends for a small dining party, and talk was of nothing but the Cruach of Alba. Still, if there was consolation, it was in the fact that Delaunay was in high spirits and called me to join him on his couch.
"Surely if you are old enough to enter the service of Narmar, this evening's conversation merits hearing," he said, patting the cushion beside him.
He was still dressed for court, and fair glowed with elegance and the flush of good wine and talk.
"You know the Comte de Forcay, of course. Gaspar, make her a bow. She is nigh a lady now. And our poetess, Telesis, I cower in your shadow. This is Quintilius Raus of Isonde, who is the finest admiral ever to command a fleet, and my lord Percy of Lagnas, Comte de Somerville, of whom you have heard tell."
I don't know what I stammered, something inept, no doubt, as I rose to make my curtsy. I was used to Gaspard Trevelyan, who was almost like an uncle to me, in so far as my notion of kin extended. Telesis de Mornay awed me, though I had met her. But these new additions, the commander of the fleet of Isande, was legend in three nations. And the Comte de Sommerville was a prince of the blood, who had led a charge against the Scaldi, with Prince Roland and Prince Benedict. It was rumoured that if the king should ever need to appoint a warlord, it would be the Comte de Sommerville. Because he figured in a tale out of my childhood, I expected he would be old, like the king. But he was no more than 50 years of age, hale and fit, with grey dimming his golden hair. A faint odour of apples clung to him. I learned later that this was a mark of the scions of Arniel in general, and of the Sommerville line in particular. He smiled pleasantly at me, so I would be less fearful of him.
"Delaunay's Anguisset,"
Quintilius Rouse shouted, beckoning me to his couch, which Alcuin shared. He seized my face in both hands and planted a kiss on it, releasing me with a grin. His weather-beaten face was dragged down on one side by a thick scar where he had been struck by a snapped cable, but his blue eyes glinted unabashedly. I could not decide if he were handsome or ugly.
"Too bad I've no taste for pain, eh?"
He patted Alcuin's knee. Alcuin smiled serenely at him. I could tell he liked the bluff admiral well enough. Alcuin enjoyed frankness.
"You're the spider's pupil. Why do ye reckon elder brother let the Cruach through?"
It took me a moment to realize that by spider he meant Delaunay, and to recall that elder brother was a sailor's term for the master of the straits, who ruled from the Three Sisters.
"If I could answer that, my lord," I said, sitting on Delaunay's couch and arranging my skirts,
"I would not be pupil, but master." Quintilius Rouse roared with laughter, and the others chuckled. Delaunay stroked my hair and smiled.
"Quintilius, my friend," he said, "if you cannot answer that, none of us can. Unless it be our gracious muse."
He looked inquiringly at Telesis, who shook her dark head.
"He let me pass for the price of a song," she said, her rich voice holding us all in thrall. Of course, I remembered, she was in exile in Alba, and would thus have been summoned to attend. "Once thence, and once back. As best I can tell, he is governed by whim." To what whim did the Cruach of Alba cater? That is the question.
Alcuin cleared his throat. It was a small sound, but everyone listened.
"They spoke of a vision."
He glanced apologetically at Delaunay.
"I was stationed close to the Alban delegation, but it is difficult to transcribe accurately and overhear, my lord. Still, I heard somewhat of a vision of the king's sister, a black boar and a silver swan."
"The king's sister?" Quintilius Rouse made a sour face. "Ye gods beyond! Lionette? What's she up to now?"
"No, no," Alcuin shook his head. "The sister of the Cruach, the Pictish king, mother of his heir."
"Lionette has naught to do with her," Gaspard Trevelyan observed. "But I note she took the Cruach's wife under her wing, or paw, as it might happen. One almost wished to warn the poor thing that there are claws beneath those velvet pads."
"Lionette de la Courcelle de Trevelyan would be well advised to guard herself against such prey," Telesis murmured. "The Cruach's wife, Falkleda, is descended from the Brugantii, under the aegis of the Red Bull. The lioness of Azal would do well to beware her horns."
"Her boys are strapping things,"
Quintilius Rouse observed, nonplussed.
"Did ye see the size of the eldest lad? None too pleased to play second fiddle to a cripple, either."
"You refer to the Prince of the Picti?" The Comte de Sommerville's tone might have sounded condescending, were it not for the obvious affection with which he addressed the naval commander.
"A dusky little thing, but almost pretty beneath the blue. Pity about the leg. What was his name?"
"Drewston,"
Delaunay said, laughing. Don't even think it, Percy.
I'd never. The Count de Somerville's eyes glinted with amusement. You know I'm too politic for that, old friend.
I sipped at a glass of wine, my head spinning at the level of conversation. Are they truly painted blue? I asked. The question sounded plaintively naive to my own ears.
As truly as the servants of Nama earn her mark, Telesis de Mornay answered me kindly. Warriors of the Cruinia bear the symbols of their caste upon their faces and bodies, tattooed in blue woad by their own Marquist's needles. Our fine lords may laugh, but young Drustan's markings bear witness to his lineage and attest that he has won his spurs in battle. Do not be misled by his twisted foot.
But what, asked Gaspard Trevelyan, do they want?
Having asked the question, he glanced around the couches. No one ventured an answer.
Do they come seeking trade?
Fulfillment of a vision. Protection from Skaldic longboats. It is rumored on the coast of Azal that the Skaldi have sought to cross the northernmost seas to raid Alba.
But what can we do? Even Quintilius Raus cannot sail a fleet up the strait.
The admiral coughed.
It is also rumored that the Dongeline ships have sought a southwesterly route, and that the Cruinia and the Dalriada make for inhospitable landings. I do not think it is protection at sea they seek.
Trade, Delaunay ran his finger absently around the rim of his glass.
Everyone desires trade, and it is a form of power, of freedom. The propagation of culture is the guarantor of immortality. How it must gall them to look across the straits and see a world untouchable. And we, the jewel of the land, so close, so far.
Do you ever wonder why the Skaldi ever press our borders?
He looked up sharply, his wits in full stride.
No. We are marked, my friends, by the heritage of blessed Eloa and his companions. We thrive where other nations struggle. We live out our days in wine, song, and abundance, nestled on the breast of this golden land, raising our sons and daughters to peerless beauty. And wonder, then, why we must defend our borders. We raise desire to an art form, and cry foul when it awakens its bloody echoes.
We have raised more than desire to an art form, said the Comte de Somerville, and there was a grim reminder of steel in his voice.
We defend our borders.
So we do, Quintilius Raus agreed. So we do.
There is a martial solemnity that follows this sort of proclamation. I heard it then, and I have heard it since. In its silence, Alcuin shook his head. But the master of the Straits has no interest in trade, he murmured. So there is somewhat more to the matter.
I have said it before, that Alcuin's gift surpassed my own in recollection of facts, the swift drawing of connections.
I saw that night a faint surprise on Delaunay's face, in his parted lips. I understood then that in this one thing, this quicksilver intuition, the pupil indeed surpassed the master. But where Alcuin went deep, Delaunay went far, and always he had knowledge he withheld from the rest of us. Some far-ranging conclusion was reached that night, for I watched his face as he came to it.
No mind, he said then, and his voice was gay as he reached for his lyre, which he played as well as any gentleman, and better than most. Tonight the king dines with his blue-marked peer, and Isandre de la Courcelle, flower of the realm, shall teach a club-foot barbarian prince to dance the gavotte. Telesis, my dear muse, will you give us the honour of a song?
I think of any of the guests, she knew best what he was about. Still she obliged him, singing in her deep, thrilling voice. So passed my first night, accepted as a nigh-adult member of Anofiel Delaunay's household. Gaspard Trevelyan left sober, while Quintilius Raus drank deep and slept it off in Delaunay's guest chambers. As for Alcuin,
He took heed of Delaunay's nod at the end of things, and left that night with the Comte de Sommerville. I do not think any contract was signed, but the Comte was gracious, and the next day an appointment was made with the Marquist to limn the base of Alcuin's mark, where his spine melded into his delicate buttocks. Chapter 15. Delaunay went twice more to court during the visit of the Cruach of Alba, and on these occasions he went alone. And there were no parties nor speculation afterward. If he learned anything further, he kept it to himself. The King of Terdange and the King of the Picts exchanged gifts and pleasantries, so far as anyone knew, and the Alban delegation rode back to the coast and sailed across the strait, accompanied by fair winds, seabirds, and the apparent goodwill of the master of the straits. Having renewed his fealty to House Courcelles, the Comte de Sommerville returned to his inland troops and his vast tracts of apple trees. Quintilius Rouse, having depleted our larder and drunk half of last year's pressing, went jovially back to Isande and his fleet, and somewhat later we heard that he had won a pitched battle at sea against the ships of the Caliph of Kebel-im-Akkad, securing a trade route for spices and silks from the east. News such as this made the visit of a barbarian chieftain from a tiny island pale in significance, so it is no surprise that the Picts faded quickly from memory. Life, after all, goes on. Of a surety I was anxious that mine should do so, and soon. Alcuin's success as a courtesan of the first rank continued. Rumour of the auction and his virgin price spread, and I believe Delaunay received inquiries on almost a daily basis. This was what he wished, to be able to choose selectively and say no when he desired. And I will say this at the outset. Never did he contract with a patron before first securing our approval. Delaunay's choice for Alcuin's third assignation was a true stroke of genius. Remembering the auction, Cecily Laveau-Perrin contracted Alcuin's services for the night of Miorette no Orchis' birthday, bestowing him, adorned in scarlet ribbons and nothing else, upon her friend. Miorette's laughter, I am told, rang from the rafters. Later people would claim it an act of brilliance, because word then spread that Delaunay's protégé could inspire even an adept of the night court, and this is true. But I claim a different reason. From that assignation, Alcuin came home heavy-lidded and smiling. He may have been her gift, but Miorette no Orchis possessed the secret of bestowing joy in the act of worshipping Nama. That is the canon of Orchis House, and that secret she shared with Alcuin. I remember it well, for the tender smile Alcuin took care not to turn on Delaunay, and the conversation our lord and master had with me that day. He bid me attend him in the inner courtyard, which is where he preferred to stage all events of significance. I sat demurely on one of the couches, waiting on his attention, while he strolled about the colonnade, hands clasped behind his back.
"You know I have received inquiries, Phaedra," he said, not quite looking at me. "Inquiries about you."
"No, my lord." It was true. He had never breathed a word of it, nor had anyone else, although my own birthday has passed some weeks gone by. I wondered if Alcuin had known, and resolved to give him a good shaking if I found he had.
"Yes, indeed. Ever since Alcuin's debut."
Now Delaunay looked at me sidelong. It was early evening, and the long rays of sun picked out the gleam of topaz flecking his grey eyes. I found it hard to concentrate on what he was saying.
"It is in my mind that you would not take it amiss if I accepted one of these offers." That got my attention.
"My lord," I breathed, scarce daring to believe. I had begun to think my ripening body would wither untasted on the vine. "No, my lord, I would not take it amiss."
"I thought not."
This time there was amusement in his glance.
"But there is somewhat we must make clear first. You need a signal.
The word landed on uncomprehending ears.
My lord?
Didier didn't tell you.
He sat down. It is something they have devised at Valerian House. I spoke to their Darwain at some length to learn what was needful. But times a patron goes too far in the throes of transport. You know that protestation is part of the game, yes? The signal is beyond that. It is a word if spoken that halts all play. You must have one, Federer. His gaze grew serious. If a patron fails to heed the signal, he or she is guilty of heresy. It is your safeguard against injury, against violating the precept of Blessed Eloa. They say it is best to choose a word that cannot be mistaken for love play. Do you wish to think on it? I shook my head. The word came unbidden to my lips. Hyacinth. It is the first time, and perhaps the only, I saw Delaunay taken aback.
The Tsingano?
If he hadn't been sitting in front of me, I would still have known his surprise from his voice.
That's the first thing you think of when you think of a safeguard.
He is my one friend.
I held his gaze stubbornly. Everyone else desires something of me, even you, my lord. If you wish me to choose another word, I will. But you have asked, and I have answered.
No. After a moment he shrugged. Why not? It's a good enough choice. No one need know you mean a Tsingani soothsayer's bibler when you speak it. I'll have it drawn into your contract, and be certain your patrons know of it.
My words had given him pause, I could tell. I wondered if he were a little jealous even. I hoped so, but didn't dare press the matter. Who are they? I asked him instead. And whose offer are you minded to take, my lord?
There have been several. Delaunay rose to pace again, most relayed indirectly, through third and fourth parties, as is often done when special talents like your own are involved. Except for one.
A frown creased his brow. He glanced reluctantly at me.
Childeric de Somme approached me himself to make an offer.
A name and a face to go with it. I felt my body tighten, but all I said was, why would he do that? He hates you, and he knows your game, my lord. He only bid on Alcuin to bait the others.
That's part of it. He likes the sight of pain.
He sat down again. De Somme is a hunter.
He loves the game, and he's clever at it. Clever enough to know you're meant as a lure. He thinks he can take the bait and evade the hook, and he wants me to know it. He's too arrogant to pass up a chance to claim a prize like you and deal me an insult in the process.
What do you want of him?
A simple enough question, fraught with so much meaning. This, beyond the provision of pleasure and the sight of pain, was my purpose. This was why Delaunay had bought my mark. No matter that he would not tell us the greater why of it, Alcuin and I had long ago realized that he valued us most of all for what we could learn.
Any information he might betray, Delaunay said grimly. De Somme ranks high in the court of Chancery. There is no grant, no treaty, no appointment that does not cross his desk at some point. He knows who has petitioned for what, and what has been ceded in exchange. He knows who will be appointed to what post and why. And like as not, he knows who profited from the death of Isabelle Lanvert.
And Edmé de Rocaille? I shivered inwardly as I named Prince Roland's first betrothed. Delaunay looked sharply at me.
Isabelle Lanvert profited from the death of Edmé de Rocaille, he said softly, and so did Childeric de Somme, for he received his appointment not long after Isabelle wed Roland. You ask what I wish to know? I wish to know who pulls de Somme's strings now. Isabelle is dead, so who does he serve, and to what end? Find that out for me, Phaedra, and I will owe you much.
As you wish, my lord. I would do it, I resolved, if it killed me. I was naive enough still in those days
not to reckon how real a possibility it might be.
Then you assent to his offer?
I started to say yes, then paused. How much is it? Delaunay smiled at my asking.
You're a true child of the Night Court, Fedra.
4,500. Seeing my expression, he stopped smiling.
My dear, Alcuin's virgin price would never have gone so high were it not for the auction, and I am afraid that the patrons you attract are not the sort to air their penchants in public. If you have been struck as truly by Kushiel's dart as I believe, then experience will do naught but hone your gift. Your asking price will rise and not diminish with time.
He cupped my face, looking sincerely at me.
Alcuin must trade on the asset of his rarity, and to preserve it he may contract but seldom. To set a high mark on his debut was necessary. But you, Fedra, Valyrian House knows of no Anguisset in living memory. Indeed, it has been so long since the world has seen your like that even Sirius, the first house, failed to recognize you. This I promise. While you live, you will be a rarity. I might have been 7 years old again, standing in the Dalwain's receiving room, where with four lines of verse, Delaunay turned me from an ill-favored bastard into the chosen of Elowa's companions. I wanted to cry, but Delaunay didn't care for tears. Childeric de Somme will be getting a bargain, I said instead.
Lord de Somme will be getting more than he bargained for.
He looked sternly at me.
I want you to be careful, Fedra. Seek nothing, ask him nothing. Let him take the hook. Think he has won this victory from me. If all goes well, he will ask for you a third time, a fourth. Risk nothing until then. Do you understand?
Yes, my lord. And if it goes poorly?
If it goes poorly, I will put half the contract fee toward your mark, and you have never to see him again.
Delaunay poked me in the arm quite sharply.
Under any circumstances, Fedra, you will not hesitate to use the signal. Is that clear?
Yes, my lord. Hyacinth, I said it a second time on purpose, just to bother him.
He ignored it. And the same rules apply. You are not to betray your learning. As far as de Somme knows, such skills as you have, you learned in the Night Court.
Yes, my lord. I paused. You took Alcuin to court to transcribe the Alban interview.
Ah, that, Delaunay broke out in his unexpected grin. I said he wrote a fair hand. I didn't tell anyone he spoke Cruinia. As far as anyone but the king himself knows, Alcuin understood only what I translated, and our fair scribe was seen by a number of intrigued potentates that day.
As interesting as that was, I was more fascinated by the fact that Delaunay was actually suggesting Ganelon de la Courcelle, the king of Terre d'Ange, knew what he was up to. I wished I could say the same, but I will be circumspect, my lord, was all I said aloud.
Good. He stood up, looking satisfied. Then I will make the arrangements.
Chapter 16. On the day of my first assignation, I swear it, I think Delaunay was more nervous than I. Even with Alcuin, he had not fussed so much. Later, when I knew my art better, I understood Delaunay better as well. As sophisticated as his knowledge and tastes might be, there was a threshold his own desires did not cross. Like many people, he understood the spice a touch of dominance might add to love play, but no more than a touch. Yet so thorough was his study of the desires of others that one forgot it was a comprehension of the mind only. In the marrow of his bones, he did not know what it was to crave the touch of the lash like a kiss. Thus, his nervousness. When I understood this, I loved him all the better for it, though of course I had already long since forgiven him. There was nothing I could not forgive Delaunay. There, he breathed, standing behind me in the great mirror, tucking in an errant lock of my hair.
You look beautiful.
He rested his hands upon my shoulders, and I gazed into the mirror. My own eyes looked back at me, dark and lustrous, as bistres smudged in by an artist's pencil, save for the single mote of scarlet. In my mirror image it flecked the right eye, vivid as a scrap of rose petal floating on calm waters. Delaunay liked the look of my hair, caught in the silk mesh of a caul, restrained in its abundance. It weighed heavily against the fine strands, straining to escape, accentuating the delicate shape of my face and the ivory pallor of my skin. It is vulgar to color youth, so the only cosmetic he had allowed me was a touch of carmine on my lips. They stood out, like the mote in my eye, vivid as rose petals. I did not recall seeing such a sensuous pout to my lower lip before. For my garb, Delaunay had again elected for simplicity. But the gown this time was red velvet, a deep and luscious shade. The bodice clung to my figure, and I marked with pleasure the way my breast swelled, white-skinned and tempting, above its neckline. There was a line of tiny jet buttons all down the back. I wondered if Childeric de Somme would undo them or rip them asunder. In the night court he would be charged extra for ripping them, but I doubted Delaunay incorporated such trivialities into his contract. The bodice dropped low on my hips to emphasize the smallness of my waist and the flatness of my stomach. I was pleased with the youthful allure of my body, and was happy to see it emphasized. From thence it hugged the fullness of my hips and dropped in straight folds, unexpectedly demure, save for the color and the luxuriant nature of the fabric.
"You are pleased at what you see," Delaunay said, amused.
"Yes, my lord."
I saw no reason to dissemble. My appearance was his investment. I turned, craning my neck, trying to imagine how I would appear from the rear when I had made my mark and the lines of the finial would rise where the fabric ended to adorn the top of my spinal knob.
"So am I. Let us hope Lord Childeric feels the same."
Delaunay removed his hands from my shoulders.
"I have a gift for you," he said, moving to his closet. "Here."
Returning, he laid a hooded cloak about my shoulders where his hands had rested. Velvet lined with silk, it was a far deeper red than my dress, a red so dark and saturated it was almost black, the color of blood spilled on a moonless night.
"The color is called sanguin," he said, watching my face in the mirror as I received his gift. "Telesis told me that in the 7th century after Eloa, it was decreed that only Anguissets might wear it. I had to send to Phyrexia to find dye-makers who remembered how to make the formula for it."
It was beautiful, truly and deeply beautiful. I wept at the sight of it, and this time Delaunay did not revile me for it, but embraced me. We are d'Angelines. We know what it is to weep at the sight of beauty.
"Be safe, Phaedra,"
he murmured. His voice stirred the court weight of my hair.
"Childeric de Somme waits for you. Remember your signal, and remember that Guy will be there if anything goes awry. I would not send you into the household of my enemy without protection."
My blood raced at the feel of his arms around me, and I turned in them, seeking his face. "I know, my lord," I whispered. But Delaunay dropped his arms and stepped back.
"It is time," he said, his expression grown distant and reserved. "Go, and may the blessing of Nama protect you."
Thus did I go forth to my first assignation.
It was dark already when the carriage set forth. Guy, immaculate in livery, sat opposite me on the cushions and said nothing, nor did I speak to him. De Somme's house was small, but in close proximity to the palace. He had a suite of rooms in the palace itself, I learned later, but preferred to maintain his own lodgings for dalliance of this nature. The servant who opened the door seemed surprised to see me attended by Guy, which emotion he marked with a haughty sniff. "That way," he said to me, pointing, and then to Guy, "you'll abide in the servants' quarters, then." As if he had not spoken, Guy moved forward and made me a bow, crisp and elegant. I hadn't known he was capable of such a courtly manner.
"My Lady Phaedra no Delaunay," he announced in his inflectionless voice, catching the servant's eye and holding it. "She is expected by Lord de Somme."
"Yes, of course." Flustered, the servant put his arm out. "My lady?" Guy stepped smartly between us.
"You will take her cloak," he said softly.
Whether it was Delaunay's manner which he had adopted, or the vestiges of his training in the Castellan Brotherhood, it quelled de Somme's servant as surely as it had the lordling in the bar long ago.
"Yes, yes, of course."
De Somme's servant snapped his fingers, beckoning urgently at the bewildered maid, who answered. "Take my lady's cloak," he said sharply to her. I unfastened the clasp and shrugged it off my shoulders. The material slithered, rich and opulent, into his waiting hands. Delaunay knew what he was about. De Somme's servant drew in his breath at the weight of the sangoir cloak, handing it to the maid, who covertly stroked the nap of the dense velvet as she folded it carefully over her arm. I held my head high, receiving their curious glances and returning them, letting them take in my crimson-marked eye. Gentry gossip, but so do servants. All first impressions matter.
"This way, my lady,"
de Somme's servant said again, but there was respect in his tone as he extended his arm. I took it graciously, permitting my fingertips to brush, just barely, his forearm. In this manner he conducted me into the presence of Childeric de Somme. His lordship was waiting in his trophy room. That was what I came to call it, at any rate. What he called it, I never knew. There were frescoes of hunting scenes on two walls. A third was taken up with a hearth, in which a fire was laid, and above which hung the de Somme coat of arms and a panoply of weapons. At the last wall was something else. Childeric de Somme had the same look I had noted at Cecily's fate. Tight braided hair and the hooded eyes of a bird of prey. He wore a subdued brocade doublet and sateen hosen, and held aloft a glass of cordial.
"Leave her, Philippe," he said dismissively.
His servant bowed and departed, closing the door behind him. I was alone with my first patron. With swift strides, Childeric de Somme closed the distance between us. His right hand, unencumbered, rose almost casually until he dashed it across my face. I staggered sideways, tasting blood, remembering the deadly accuracy with which he'd hurled his lees in the game of Cotabos. He still held the glass of cordial in his left hand and hadn't spilled a drop.
"You will kneel in my presence, whore," he said nonchalantly.
I sank down on my knees, abeyant, red velvet skirts pooling around me on the flagstones. They were cold, despite the fire. I watched his polished boots as he paced around me.
"Why does an Orfiel Delaunay send an Anguissette to tempt the likes of me?"
he asked, circling behind me. I felt his hand dig into my enmeshed curls, wrenching my head backward, and stared up at his hooded, gleaming eyes. My throat felt vulnerable and exposed. "I don't know, my lord," I whispered, my voice constricted with fear.
"I don't believe you."
He pressed his thigh hard against the back of my head, sliding his hand down to encircle my throat.
"Tell me, Phaedra no Delaunay, what your lord wishes of me. Does he think me so easily ensnared, hm?"
He punctuated his words with a jerk of his hand.
"Does he suppose I'll spill my secrets in idle pillow talk with a rented whore?"
Another spasm of his clutching fingers. He was applying pressure to the spot where my pulse beat in my throat, and spots of black danced in my vision.
"I don't know."
I whispered the words again, a strange languor invading my body, as consciousness began to ebb. With an effort, I turned my head, feeling the muscles of his thigh move beneath my cheek. My breath seemed to come hot and labored.
Eloa.
Desarm froze, exhaling the word. His hand loosened on my throat, rising to cup the back of my head.
You really are, aren't you?
I heard wonder and amusement in his voice. He hadn't been sure, I thought, and in some part of my mind took note of the fact that it had been worth over 4,000 ducats to him to claim a victory over Delaunay anyway.
Prove it then, little Longiset. As you are, on your knees, please me.
So he said, but he hadn't needed to tell me. I was already turning as I knelt, grasping his boots with unclasped hands, sliding my palms up the slick leather. I knew what he wished, knew his desire as surely as the sea knows the tidal urges of the moon. The muscles of his thighs twitched beneath my gliding hands. With a curse he hurled his glass aside. I heard it shatter somewhere as my fingertips grazed his erect phallus, straining against the fabric of his hosen. He dug both hands into my hair as I undid the buttons. The art of languissement is an ancient and subtle one, and I am ashamed to say that I employed none of its niceties. Then again, that is not always the nature of my art. Desarm groaned as his phallus sprang free, the tip of it nudging my parted lips, and his hands clenched on my head, urging me to take his shaft into my mouth, deep into my throat. Ah, if only he had known! I accepted him eagerly, lips and tongue working frantically, putting into practice at last the knowledge of 1,000 hours of study and more. He groaned again as he climaxed, shoving me away and tearing the mesh net loose from my hair. I fell back sprawling, my hair tumbling in wild disarray about my shoulders. Childeric Desarm advanced upon me. "Whore!" he shouted, backhanding me across the mouth. I licked my lips, tasting blood mixed with his seed.
"Ill-gotten spawn of Nama!"
Another blow, glancing. I looked up through the hair spilled over my eyes and saw his phallus stirring to erection. Desarm gained control of himself with a shudder.
"On your feet," he said, grinding out the words. "Take off your clothes."
Rising, I reached behind my back with trembling fingers and began to undo the jet buttons one by one. Desarm watched, his eyes hooded.
"There," he said harshly, pointing to a pallet of cushions.
A swatch of white silk was spread across them.
"I have in mind to make a new coat of arms in honor of Anarthiel Delaunay."
When I let fall the red velvet gown, he shoved me so that I stumbled, naked, toward the pallet.
"I have paid your virgin price,"
Desarm said menacingly, advancing toward me.
"Pray you have played your lord true, and award me with the badge of victory, Phedre. On your back!"
He moved like a stalking beast, shedding clothes, looming over me as I lay upon the pallet, forcing my legs over his shoulders. I do not know what it is like for other women. There was no arousement such as I had seen in the showing at Camellia House, and yet for me I was ready as ever an adept was for her first joining. With one smooth thrust, Desarm pierced me to the core, and even as I cried out at the pain of it, the face of Blessed Nama swam in my vision, and I gasped with pleasure. Again and again he thrust himself into me, and I felt my body pliant in his hands, while waves of pain and pleasure beat at me like the wings of Nama's doves in her temple. He was Delaunay's enemy, and I should have hated him. I found my arms were wound tight about his neck, and I cried out his name as he spent himself inside of me. It may be that it sobered him in some part. I do not know. He drew away and breathed heavily alongside me, loosening his hair at last from the tight confinements of his braid. He looked more handsome with it falling about his shoulders.
"I have this, then, at least."
He eased the swatch of white silk from beneath me, bearing the vivid red stain of my virgin blood.
His predatory eyes were strangely calm.
"You know what I desire, Fedra."
"Yes, my lord," I murmured. I rose obediently from his pallet to cross to the device on the fourth wall, the last wall. I did not need to be told. I stood spread-eagled against the X-shaped cross, his whipping post. I could feel his breath against my skin as he fastened the thongs at my wrists and ankles. The rough wood of the cross chafed my hip bones.
"You are the most splendid thing I have ever seen,"
he murmured, jerking tight the ties binding my left wrist. My fingers splayed out in anguished protest.
"Tell me what Delaunay desires."
"I don't know," I gasped as he wrenched my right ankle and lashed it to the cross.
"Truly."
He rose, and his breath tickled my ear, and I felt the trailing ends of a flogger caress my lower back. "I swear it." And then the lash began to fall. I could not count the number of times. It was not like my childhood punishment at the hand of the Darwain's chastiser, for there was no mediator, no quota of blows. I know only that I writhed and pleaded against the rough wood, and still the lash fell mercilessly, bearing out Childeric Disarm's hatred of my lord. Once I gave up and sagged against my bonds, offering no resistance. He came to me then and reached between my legs with his fingers, stirring me until I pleaded, humiliated, for a different release. Then the lash fell again. At last his arm tired, and he came behind me once more. I felt his fingers spread my buttocks.
"I paid Anarthiel Delaunay a virgin price,"
he whispered in my ear. I felt the blunt head of his phallus probe at my nether orifice and dug my fingertips into the rude wood of the cross, driving splinters beneath my nails.
"And I will take it to the last centime."
He did. Chapter 17. Afterward, Cecily came to visit and took me on an excursion to a sanctuary of Nama, some miles outside the city, famed for its hot springs. It was strange to treat with her as an almost equal, after so many years as her pupil, but she was gracious as ever, and any awkwardness soon passed between us. There was a chill to the spring air, and the sun was warm and bright, and it was good to see the pale green shoots of new growth emerging as we drove into the countryside. We were well received by the priests and priestesses of Nama at the temple, and though they were discreet, I dare say they recognized the name of Cecily Lavaux-Perrin.
"After all," she said in the bathhouse, shrugging gracefully into one of the robes they had given us, "we are servants of Nama, my dear. We may as well indulge ourselves in such amenities as that avails us."
The hot springs bubbled in rocky pools, releasing wisps of steam in the cold air. Only a few early flowers bloomed, intrepid and pale, but there was a warble of birdsong, giving promise of summer to come. I followed Cecily as she walked carefully over the rocks, following suit as she slipped out of her robe and lowered her body into the warm, slightly acrid waters.
"Ah!"
She sighed with pleasure, settling her submerged form on rocks long since worn smooth by water and the luxuriating bodies of innumerable bathers.
"They say the waters have good healing qualities, you know. Come, let me see."
She examined the welts on my back as I turned obediently. "Skin deep. There'll be no trace of them in a week.
I've heard Childeric Desarmes makes love as if he's hunting boar. Is it true?"
I thought of him wielding his phallus like a spear and almost laughed. "It is true enough," I said. The warmth of the waters was beginning to seep into my bones, filling my limbs with a feeling of lassitude and soothing the minor pains Desarmes had dealt my flesh into a sweet, warm ache. He has the passion of his fury, at least.
"Is there aught for which your studies with me left you unprepared?"
"No," I answered truthfully, shaking my head. "Lord Desarmes desired little in the manner of art."
"Others will,"
she assured me, adding, "Fedra, if you have questions, do not hesitate to ask me." With that she dropped the matter, and her eyes took on a glint I remembered well from the boudoir gossip of Sirius House.
"Do you think he will ask for you again?"
Remembering Desarmes' rage, the wild blows of the flogger against my skin, and his breath hot against my neck, I smiled. "You may be sure of it," I murmured, tilting my head back to submerge my hair. It fell, waterlogged and silken, down the length of my back as I straightened. "He will tell himself it is to beat Delaunay at his game," I told her, "but that is only what he will tell himself."
"Be careful."
The admonishment in her voice was stern enough that I took heed, glancing at her. "If Desarmes realizes you know what you're about, he will be frightened. And that, my dear, will make him truly dangerous." Cecily sighed, looking of a sudden tired and aged through the wreathing steam. "Anafiel Delaunay does not reckon he does. Equipping a child of your proclivities with that much knowledge and sending you into certain danger." There were 100 things I longed to ask her, but I knew well enough that she would not answer. "My Lord Delaunay knows full well what he does," I said instead.
"Let us hope you are right."
Cecily spoke the words firmly, sitting straight in the hot spring and looking once more like the prized blossom of Sirius House that she had been.
"Come, we are not too late to join in the luncheon meal, and the servants of Nama lay a fine table at her sanctuary. If we do not dawdle over much, there will be time to soak again before we need return to the city."
We dined well that day, and made our return to the city before sundown. I made my report to Delaunay that night, and he seemed well enough at ease with it, praising me for doing naught but letting Desarmes swallow the bait of our assignation, hook and all.
"Tell him nothing," he said, satisfaction in his voice, "and he will tell you something in time, Fedra, in hopes of priming the pump. It is human nature to give in hope of getting. Lord Desarmes will give. It is inevitable."
Going to his desk, he took out a small pouch and tossed it to me. I caught it by reflex, surprised. Delaunay grinned.
"He sent it by courier this afternoon. A patron gift toward your mark. It is his will, I think, that the Marquist limn his conquest of you upon your skin, as a fair reminder to me. Do you wish to refuse?"
The pouch weighed heavy in my hand. It was the first coin of my own I had ever owned. I shook my head. "If it serve your will, my lord, so let it be. He was the first." I might have wished for some sign of jealousy, were I less of a realist. Delaunay gazed into some unknowable distance, nodding to himself. He was not displeased.
"Then let it be. I will make an appointment with the Marquist."
And thus began my career as a servant of Namar. A week later to the day, I had my first meeting with the Marquist. As Cecily had predicted, the wheels marring my back and sides had faded to nothingness in that time, leaving my skin a clean slate for the Marquist's art. Kushiel's chosen heal swiftly.
We have need of it.
Because Delaunay was Delaunay, nothing but the finest would do for his adepts. I went to the same man as Alcuin, a master of the trade. Robert Tielar had been at his art for 20 years, and his services came dear. I had long known this would be the case, for Delaunay had paid dear in purchasing my mark. I was not Alcuin, to remember to the last clause and bylaw the regulations governing every guild in the nation, but I knew the rules of my own well enough. The Guild of the Servants of Nama does not allow for outright slavery. Delaunay did not own my mark so much as he held it in trust for Nama, but until such time as I made it, I was indentured into his service. All contract fees belonged to Delaunay. Only patron gifts freely given in homage to Nama could go toward my mark. I spent the first hour in the Marquis's shop naked, lying flat on my stomach with my head pillowed on my arms, while Master Robert Tielar muttered around my backside with a pair of calipers, taking my measurements and transferring them to paper. When he was done, I sat up and donned my clothes, admiring the masterful sketch of a part of me I seldom saw. I particularly liked the curve of my lower back, widening like the base of a fiddle from my narrow waist.
"'Tis not for your vanity I do this, missy,' Master Tialar snapped, turning to his apprentice. "'Run down the street, lad, and fetch Lord Delaunay from the wine shop.'
While I sat waiting on his limbing table, he ignored me, fetching out a rolled scroll from its cubbyhole and pinning it up on a cork wall next to my sketch. I recognized Alcuin's mark from its base, which he already bore on his skin, but still I gasped to see the design in its entirety. It was surpassingly beautiful, and I understood why Robert Tialar had earned the right to be called master. Each of the 13 houses has its own mark pattern, but it is a different matter for servants of Nama not attached to any house. Our marks, within certain strictures, are highly individualized. Of course, the designs are highly abstracted, but a trained eye can pick out the underlying forms, and I soon saw many in Alcuin's. Elegant scrolling at the base suggested a mountain stream, and the slim, supple trunk of a white birch rose upward, a fine pattern of birch leaves twining about it and crowning it in a delicate spiral at the finial. The lines were strong, but the colours subtle, soft greys and charcoals that would echo Alcuin's unusual colouring, with the merest hint of a pale green along the edges of the leaves.
What Master Robert Tialar designed for me was different.
Delaunay entered the Marquis sharp laughing, bringing with him a breeze of wine and good conversation, but he soon sobered to the task at hand, poring with Master Tialar over bits of foolscap as sketch after sketch was drafted and refined or discarded. I grew impatient, but he would not let me see until they had a sketch which pleased them both.
"'What do you think, Fedra?' Delaunay turned to me, grinning, holding out the rough design.
It was bold, far bolder than Alcuin's mark. With some effort I recognized the underlying design, which was based on a very old pattern, the Briar Rose. Somehow Master Tialar had kept the dramatic vigour of the archaic lines, yet infused them with a subtlety that spoke at once of the vine, the bond, and the lash. The thorny lines were stark black, accented in only a few choice hollows with a teardrop of scarlet, a petal, a drop of blood, the mote in my eye. Primitive yet sophisticated, I adored it. No matter how many visits to the Marquists were required to execute the design in full, to restore it to pristine condition after my patron's untender mercies, it was worth it. "'My lord, it is wonderful,' I answered him honestly.
"'I thought as much,' Delaunay preened with satisfaction, while Master Tialar set about transferring the design to the master sketch of my measurements, muttering to himself.
It was astonishing to see how the lineaments bloomed beneath the sure gestures of his crabbed hands. His apprentice crowded near, craning to see around Delaunay.
"'I'll be in the wine shop,' Delaunay said to Master Tialar. "'You'll send the boy for me when she's done?'
The Marquist answered with an affirmative grunt, deep in concentration. Dropping a kiss on my dishevelled curls, Delaunay waved and departed. I waited and waited some more, while Master Tialar copied the design to his very exacting satisfaction. And when that was done, it was time to disrobe again, lying naked while he retraced the base of my mark yet again, checking his measurements with the calipers. The quill scratched my skin, and the ink tickled. He slapped my buttock once when I wriggled, absent-mindedly, as one might reprimand a restless child. After that, I held myself motionless. After a small eternity, the base was outlined. Chin propped on my elbows, I watched as Master Tialar gathered the tools of his profession, the ink trough and his tappers. His apprentice watched me out of the corner of his eye, nervous and excited. The boy was no more than 14, and I smiled to think of my effect on him. He blushed as he mixed the ink and covered it by bustling about the brazier, heaping it with coal, until the Marquis's shop was as warm and toasty as a baker's oven. Master Tielar snapped at him for it, and he blushed again. I didn't care. Being naked, it felt good. And at last it was time for the Marquis to start limbing. As is customary, he began at the base of my spine, at the very knob where it ends, below the dimples of the lower back. I could not see him choose a tapper and dip it in the trough, but I felt it against my skin, the prick of a dozen tight-clustered needles and the seeping wetness of the ink. Then he struck the tapper with his mallet, and a dozen needles pierced my skin, impregnating the flesh at the base of my spine with a dollop of ink-black. The pain of it was an exquisite shock. I made an involuntary sound, my hips moving of their own volition, to thrust against the hard surface below me, grinding my pubis into the limbing table. Master Tielar swatted me again. "Damn donkey sets," he growled, concentrating on his work. "Grandpère always said they was worse than criers or bleeders. Now I know why." Ignoring his complaint, I held myself still, with the greatest of efforts, while he continued tapping, tapping, tapping with the mallet, piercing the lines of my mark into my skin. I savored every moment of it. Chapter 18. This marked the beginning of a period of time that in many ways was the finest of my life. All that Delaunay had prophesied for me so long ago came to pass. Word of Delaunay's anguisette spread like a slow fire, the kind that smoulders and burns below the surface, impossible to extinguish. The offers continued to come, most of them discreet, a few direct. It was during the first year that Delaunay's cunning in the matter of our exposure became evident to me. Alcuin's patrons were a select group, most of them hand-picked and targeted by Delaunay. Friends, acquaintances, or cordial enemies, they had been to Delaunay's house, had watched Alcuin grow from a beautiful boy. Delaunay had cast out a net with his auction, but he had certain fish in mind. As he drew it in, he selected his catch with care. With me, it was another matter. Many patrons, like Childeric Desormes, Delaunay had anticipated, but others, many others, he had not. If Alcuin was a net cast on known waters, I was a line thrown out at sea, and not even Anarfiel Delaunay knew for certain who would rise to the bait. And lest it be thought that my assignation with Childeric Desormes laid the pattern for all further patrons, I hastened to disabuse anyone of this notion. My second assignation, a member of the Exchequer, who paid dearly for the privilege, could not have been more different. Slight and deferential, Pépin Lachey seemed to me at first glance the sort of patron far more likely to contract Alcuin than I. Indeed, in the bedchamber, he did naught but remove his clothes, lie upon the bed, and bid me in an uninterested voice to please him. If Childeric Desormes required little of my art, Pépin Lachey required all of it. Disrobing, I climbed onto the bed and knelt beside him, beginning with the caress of trailing willows. I loosed my hair and flung it over him, letting it spill over him like water, slowly drawing it down the length of his body. He lay unmoving and unexcited. Undeterred, I set about the arousement, beginning with confidence. In the hour that followed, I tried every technique Cecily had taught us, working with fingers, lips and tongue, on every part of Pépin Lachey's body, from the tips of his ears to the ends of his toes. In the end, desperate, I resorted to a measure usually used by the cheapest of prostitutes, a crude manipulation called coaxing the turtle. Pépin Lachey's member responded, stirring to a half-hearted salute. Fearing to lose even that, I bestrode him and began to move urgently. But instead of rising further, his phallus grew limp and slipped out of me. Near to tears, I met his cold gaze. "You're not much good at this, are you?" he asked contemptuously, spilling me off him. "I'll show you how it's done."
"My lord, I am sorry.
I fell silent as he reached into the nightstand and brought out silk bonds, making no protest as he tied my wrists and ankles to the bedposts. When he brought out the pincers and his phallus began to rise untouched, engorged and swollen, I understood. Where Childeric Desarm had been brutal, Pépin Lachey was the epitome of delicacy. I suppose it takes an exacting soul to maintain the balance of the royal treasury. He worked on me for what seemed like hours. When I cried out at the torment of it, he thrust a padded leather gag in my mouth, asking first if I wished to give the signal. I shook my head, feeling tears of shame trickle backward from the corners of my eyes. My entire body was ablaze with pain, and painful with desire. "If you wish to give the signal," he said formally, prying my mouth open and inserting the thick gag, "rap upon the bedpost, and I will hear. Do you understand?" I nodded, unable now to speak. "Good." And with that he continued to work upon me, until I nearly bit through the gag. After each assignation always came the interview. I have no way of knowing how many nuggets of knowledge we laid at Delaunay's feet, how many pieces of the puzzle he set in place after our recitations. At that time, it must be understood, while we knew a juicy morsel of information when we heard it, neither Alcuin nor I grasped the ends toward which he strove. Of information, there was always a steady trickle, for there was increasing unrest in the realm. The king suffered a mild seizure, which left him with a palsy in his right hand. Ysant de la Courcelle remained unwed.